Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, Clark County schools are on track to begin a phased reopening next week.
Our hope is that now we're host a lot of the large family gathering kind of activities, and that we will be able to safely continue our return back.
We'll talk to Superintendent Dr. Zernona Thomas. This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Also today, the impact of the pandemic on Black Americans.
What do you do all day except just stay in your house and hope that nothing bad happens? For lack of better words, excuse my language, it's almost you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Those stories, our panel on the ACC budget, and the draft plan to redevelop Bethel Midtown Village, coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition goes to the source, to the people affected by the news.
This plant could shut down, and a lot of very good people could lose their jobs.
Like this, it's completely ridiculous that we should feel unsafe to go to school.
I'm Noelle King. For stories that matter to you, listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. The Clark County School District will begin its transition to in-person classes again on Monday after a turbulent fall semester that started out virtual, switched to in-person for elementary and middle school students, and then was forced to return to all virtual as coronavirus cases spiked again. Last week, we had President of the School Board, Dr. Lakeisha Gant, on the show to talk to us about the decision-making processes of the return to in-person instruction. And here with us today, we have Superintendent of the Clark County School District, Dr. Zernona Thomas, and Chief Academic Officer Brannon Gaskins to give us more about the details and logistics of the reopening.
Thank you so much, both of you, for giving us a few minutes. First, I'll start with you, Dr. Thomas. Could you give us a broad overview of what this transition will look like as Clark County schools are heading back to in-person classes this month? Can you give us a broad overview of what this transition will look like?
Yes, so we have some different phases that we are beginning as a school district, and we will begin that first phase of return on Monday. And it will be for our students who are served through our adaptive special education program. And that group will be coming back somewhere between 2 to 4 days a week. And then starting March 1st, we will begin to return our pre-K through second grade students and our Office of Early Learning. So some of those students are younger than that pre-K age. And phase three will begin on March 15th, and we will add in third through fifth grade as well as our high school students, but in a cohort model. And then the exact next week, we will have all of our students back 4 days a week, but again, it would be some are in a cohort model. Others are in a coming Monday and Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, allowing for us to do some additional deep cleaning. We will, of course, be cleaning thoroughly every day, but we'll do more intensive cleaning in our buildings midweek and take that day for synchronous learning. And then we will return back to the option of face-to-face on Thursdays and Fridays. And this is a optional choice for families. They do not have to return back to face-to-face. They can choose to continue virtually.
And we know that there has been some difficulty keeping staff like bus drivers throughout the pandemic. Will there be sufficient transportation for all students that need it? And what safety measures will be taken on school buses?
You're right. Staffing has been a challenge with our transportation department, but we've also run into the same issues with a couple of our schools because we have managed to have very low positivity rates in our schools. The issue has been those who have been exposed, and as a result of that exposure, they're having to quarantine. It is the exposure and quarantining that is more problematic than actual positive cases. We'll continue with required mask wearing. We provide masks on our buses for students when they arrive in the morning if they do not have them. Distancing as much as possible on buses, so we are doing reduced routes on our buses.
The other thing is we have a modified high school bell schedule. So our high school students will be going to school between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. Usually our bus drivers, they serve middle school and high school at the same time. And so if we are short bus drivers, that helps us prevent having to double up routes. We are very committed to having bus routes of no more than 44 students. And with high school being at a modified schedule, that helps us meet that need of not having to double up routes, not having to have students wait outside for another bus to come if a bus driver is out for whatever reason.
As we mentioned, in the fall semester, classes began virtually, then moved to in-person, then moved back to virtual. Are you hopeful that this time the transition will be permanent?
I think definitely hopeful. When we went out in late November, early December, it was a result of increased number of staff absences. We did see a lot of that after Thanksgiving, and that was what we had projected. That was why we had initially made the decision to stay out an additional 2 weeks after the holiday break, the winter break, because we anticipated another spike. And we were right. I mean, the numbers were significantly higher. And now what we've seen, now that we are almost a month out, well, actually a month out, is those numbers have started to decrease significantly, not in an ideal state of positivity rate in cases per 100,000, but much better than they were a month ago or even 3 weeks ago. And so we are seeing that downward trend. And our hope is that now we're post a lot of the large family gathering kind of activities and that we will be able to safely continue our return back without, one, any significant spread, but also any significant impact to our ability to staff.
Some teachers have expressed concern that their students are not on track to complete the required coursework on time this year. And can you tell us what resources that the board can help allocate to help students catch up? And will there be any leeway for classes that don't get through all the material?
Our largest concern around course completion is really at the high school level, because those students are working toward Carnegie credits. We are planning summer school if summer school is needed for those students. I think with our elementary and our middle school students, that is a big challenge for us. We are working on having a summer school and enrichment program for those students as well. But realistically, we're going to have to embed some of that learning loss in the next grade level. We'll never be able to catch up completely in one summer or even in one school year. So we're just going to have to work with our teachers and our families strategically to make sure that those students receive that those standards in their next grade level.
Mr. Gaskins has done an excellent job with his team of starting to think creatively and out of the box in terms of how we support those students over the summer. So, you know, it could be a traditional school-based model with opportunities for enrichment and acceleration. It may be working between Mr. Gaskins and Mr. Lawrence Harris on our community partnerships and finding ways that we can support students within community settings, within camp settings.
My final question, the head of the CDC said that having teachers vaccinated isn't necessarily a prerequisite to opening schools safely, but there are over 20 states that have made teachers currently eligible for the vaccine. Do you think that teachers and support staff should be included in the 1A vaccination group in Georgia?
Definitely. We were very hopeful that 1B would be moving up sooner than it has. And we have worked, our lead school nurse, Amy Rourke, has worked diligently with multiple partner healthcare partners in the community to devise a plan to get all of our teachers vaccinated when we are legally able to do so. And we thought that would have been really about 2 weeks ago. The hope had been that 1B was close on the horizon and we would be able to provide support for our staff to receive those vaccines in our buildings. And we've been very disappointed, honestly, that that is not the case. And I'm a very strong advocate of that being moved up. And while we have been told that it is not essential, I think that anything that we can do to potentially reduce the risk and to have that as an option for families, we need to take advantage of that.
That is it for me. Is there anything that you wanted to say that I didn't address that you just wanted to get out for our listeners?
I just think our staff are overwhelmingly excited to be able to see and work with students face to face. They miss our students. I thank our teachers and our leaders and all of our support staff and operations staff for how flexible they have continued to be. So we're just looking forward to giving those students an opportunity to come back to the buildings.
Dr. Zernona Thomas is the superintendent of the Clark County School District, and Brandon Gaskins is chief academic officer. I just want to thank both of you for giving us a few minutes today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, we're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley, and today joining me to discuss the week in news and politics are Blake Odd from Flagpole Magazine, Gwen O'Looney from WXAG, and Chris Dowd from Athens Politics Nerd. So let's start first off with the Marin Commission spending a day and a half this week on their budget retreat, basically starting the process of putting this year's budget together. Gwen, this has been something you've been involved in. Give us sort of the lay of the land about what they're doing right now.
Well, I think this is a very important step that's been added to the budget process, and that the commission is meeting with the mayor early to work with him on setting the priorities. And then that way, when he is developing his recommended budget, which is due usually early April, mid-April, then they will they'll be together more. There will be less work in the future because they have started together in talking about things. The mayor still has the right, of course, to introduce things that haven't been agreed upon, and the commission, I'm sure, will find things as they move along.
The commission has highlighted four big priorities for focused attention. So, Chris, can you tell us what those budget priorities are?
Yeah, their priorities are public safety, workforce development, homelessness and affordable housing, and community engagement. And I know public safety was a big issue last year, and so that's kind of a continuation of that, I believe. And then workforce development and affordable housing are sort of just really big challenges. And as far as community engagement, that one kind of surprised me that it made a list of four, because I think our community engagement right now is pretty good, actually. And I think Jeff Montgomery, you know, is doing a great job working with Kelly Gertz to make those regular videos that they're putting out. So I think that they've actually really improved on that. over the past few years. So, and I'm glad they're continuing to, because it is important.
I agree with Chris. They've done an excellent job of using the tools that are most effective during COVID to keep open communications. All of their meetings, et cetera, from the audit committee on, are on YouTube. So I think we're in great shape with community engagement. I am very interested in them looking at not defunding police, but maybe adding hope to our police having a different, less militaristic, less gun-oriented approach to events.
Well, one thing I know that that Mayor Gers wants to do is he wants to actually raise pay for police, which I think will help them attract better candidates and retain their best officers, because there's always been a lot of turnover in our police department because it doesn't pay very well. And a lot of officers start their careers here in Athens and then move on to someplace like Atlanta or the Gwinnett County Sheriff's Office, where the pay is higher. So we lose quite a few officers on an annual basis.
And that has been happening. They've been scalping us, they call it. They've been scalping us since the 80s. We have had to compete with much richer counties, and they see Athens as an excellent training field. We definitely have competition, and I don't know if we'll ever get to where we can compete with them.
And another thing that's being discussed is bringing in more mental health specialists. Right now, they started out with one team and then added a second last year, where they pair a mental health professional with a police officer to kind of help people who have mental health issues navigate the system. So they could add some more of that type of thing to the department.
I would like to see an assessment of how well they've been used to avoid escalation of events. I think that's really important for us to look at on how they're being, you know, how easily accessible they are and how wanted they are by our police.
Do we have any idea about the budget process, about how we're doing locally with revenue, especially with sectors like our service industry still struggling?
Well, the projections last year were pretty optimistic. The manager Williams didn't seem to think that the county was going to lose a whole lot of revenue. And as far as I know, that still holds true. We haven't seen the budget projections for the coming year. I wouldn't imagine they'd be much different. I think their tax collections have been pretty steady. They rely a lot on property taxes, and those haven't really been affected by the economy. Property values are still continuing to rise at a pretty good clip. So I think they're in pretty good shape. And then once you also factor in some of the federal assistance that they got last year, and there should be some more coming down the pike to kind of backfill any holes that they might have.
I want to move on to the Bethel Midtown Village redevelopment. So this week, we did see a draft plan for that redevelopment, and the public has a chance to look at the plan and comment before February 19th, before the commission is expected to vote in early March.
Well, this is a really major project. That's going to essentially extend downtown about five blocks to the north of Doherty Street. And what they're going to do is in phases, they're going to tear down Bethel Midtown Village and the public housing at Hoyden College. And they're going to replace that with a much denser development that's going to have about 700 to 850 apartments, as well as some retail space, possibly a new health clinic, and then something will be done at some point, not sure what yet, with the planning department building, and Denny Tower will probably also be rebuilt as part of that as well down the line. It's going to be two-thirds below market rate housing and one-third above market rate, so there will be twice as many affordable units as there currently are on that property, probably more than twice just because of the density involved, but at least two times as many. And this has been done with, even with the pandemic, they got a lot of the team behind this, the Housing Authority and Columbia Residential, which is our private developer partner, done a lot of outreach in the community. And the commissioners were very happy with the amount of input that they've already gathered, especially from the residents who currently live there. And one thing that's important to note too is that this is going to be done in phases. And so most people who live there are going to be able to stay during the construction process. They might kind of be shuffled around within the development where they'll have to tear down one part, then build a new building, and then put some new people from the old building, move them into the new one, things like that. But everyone who lives there is guaranteed to be able to have a place in the new development. Everyone who currently lives there will be able to continue living there at the same rent that they're currently paying.
What they've used is essentially the basic village concept. So I think that's good. I think we need to be looking, though, at Columbia Richmond to look at its numbers and how well it's done as far as transients is concerned, as far as vacancies are concerned, to see if the approach that we're using needs to be adjusted in any way. I think we have to be really careful. This is a huge, as he was saying, five blocks of development, and we want it to be a successful residential mixed community. And that's a big step for our downtown.
It's a big change. I agree that they should look to what happened in Columbia, Brookside, and try to improve upon that if they can. So right now, if you're on Dougherty Street, you're pretty much on the north end of downtown. But after this is all built, you're going to be in the middle of downtown on Dougherty Street.
When you put it that way, it's easier to visualize.
Well, one thing that I think is really great is they're going to be restoring the street grid. When Bethel was built back in the 60s, the early 60s, and this happened in other parts of downtown too, you know, they really messed up the street grid. You know, you can look at the federal building over off Dougherty near Thomas as another example of that, where the streets just kind of dead end. You know, and you have like little blocks that are remnants, but there's not a grid anymore. So they're going to straighten out Lumpkin and have an actual true street grid through this area, which will make it really integrated into downtown. There's going to be a public art component with a connection to the planned art walk on Jackson Street leading to the Linden House. And there's going to be a connection to the Greenway on Pulaski Creek.
And Blake, we're going to let you have the last word there because that is our time for this week. I do want to thank my guests, Blake Aud, Gwen O'Looney, and Chris Dowd.
Hello, I'm Betsy Bean, publisher of Boom Athens Magazine. When I launched Boom, I knew I was writing for a serious, engaged audience, and I guessed that my readers listened to WUGA, as I do every day. I thought we would be a natural fit, and that's proved true. In a word, WUGA gives Boom cachet. Find out how you can become an underwriter by emailing wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shube.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. As Americans have continued to grapple with COVID-19 over the last year, it's become increasingly clear to many that the pandemic has shined a light on racial inequities in our healthcare system. Black Americans face greater challenges, by and large, in accessing healthcare resources, including vaccines. And now, new research shows that beyond the physical toll of the coronavirus, Black Americans also face significant mental health concerns as a result of the pandemic. That research was led by Ryan Cobb, an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Georgia. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you give us a quick summary of this study and why you decided to pursue it?
So obviously, like most Black Americans, my family has been adversely impacted by the COVID-19 outbreak. We decided to focus in on how the COVID-19 outbreak affects the mental health of Black Americans. And so it really has its origins in a conversation with my family, my parents specifically, and that their fear of the COVID-19 outbreak and what it actually, during the beginning of the outbreak, the fear of what the outbreak could mean to their health. And so their fear, and many Blacks' fear, is that the outbreak represents a drastic effect on their health. And even though my parents literally live two blocks away from the local hospital, they believe that because of medical discrimination, they may be treated differently or unfairly relative to whites that also live in the city. And that for them was distressing. And so what we found is that, number one, most Black Americans believe that around 60% of Black Americans believe that the COVID-19 outbreak represented a major threat to their personal health. Number two, that the majority of Black Americans believe that medical institutions treat them unfairly relative to whites. And so then we looked in our major finding is number three, that both factors individually and jointly predict higher levels of psychological distress among Blacks.
Well, African Americans across the country still experience a lot of racial discrimination in a variety of contexts, including medical settings, as you point out in your study. So how has COVID-19 and the pandemic exacerbated some of the issues long experienced by the African American community, especially when it comes to healthcare?
It's given life and really a voice to, I think, what many Black Americans have already felt about the medical system. It's also in terms of exacerbating health disparities with mental health, particularly among Blacks. It's at least my parents are in a point of near panic. And I think many Black Americans that we're not quite sure how individuals can contract COVID. We're definitely sure that if an individual contracts COVID, that they may not get the best help inside the hospital settings. And so really, what do you do all day except just stay in your house and hope that nothing bad happens? If you contract COVID, the possibility that you die is a real possibility. A higher possibility that you'll have some long-term health effects, which is something that's coming out more and more through other studies funded through the NIH. And also just, for lack of better words, excuse my language, it's almost you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Let me ask you what you think healthcare providers can do to start dismantling the inequalities that seem steeped into the system for Black Americans or against Black Americans.
Just broadly, there's some on-the-ground core work that needs to be done. Also, number two, having these really culturally sensitive conversations, and the NIH and the CDC are trying, but also to also further try to have these conversations. And we're seeing evidence of, especially for Blacks and Latinos and less in areas that are poor, having less access to vaccines. Blacks are more likely to believe that COVID-19 is threatening, but whites are more likely to have the vaccine. Really being mindful of these disparities, because on one hand, the federal government has a continued history of oppressing Blacks as well as treating them as, for lack of better words, lab rats. And so on one hand, they can't say, hey, trust us now, this vaccine's serious, it's affecting your community, trust us, take this vaccine. And then on the other hand, for reasons that are unclear, these groups not have equal access to the vaccine.
Well, Dr. Cobb, I think your information is valuable and your perspective is one I think that we appreciate.
Thank you. I appreciate you all. Thank you for reaching out.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Now, a story about math. And it would be easy to start off with a light quip about how lots of us are terrible at math, or how we hated taking math in school. But let's not do that, because there's some truth behind the humor. Lots of students struggle with math, and even more don't particularly enjoy studying it. So how do we change that? What can we do to help kids succeed in math? Stacy Newharth Pritchett has one answer to that question based on her research. She's the Associate Dean for Academic Programs and Professor in UGA's Mary Frances Early College of Education, and she spoke to WUGA's Martin Matheny earlier this week.
Dr. Newharth Pritchett, thanks for talking to our listeners today.
Thank you.
Your research
points pretty squarely to pre-kindergarten programs being an important factor in future math success. Can you talk a little bit more about what you found in some more detail?
Sure. So the program that we examined was the Georgia pre-kindergarten program, and it was delivered within a local school district that had a high proportion of children who were living in poverty. So one of the wonderful things that came out of this program was access for these four-year-olds to be able to make a smooth transition to public school. So although parents are very well equipped to work with children in their homes and, you know, help them understand the foundational building blocks, sometimes parents are not fully aware of all the foundational pieces. So the access to this pre-kindergarten program provides them with some of the tools with regard to academic language that's associated with mathematics learning. So those could be exposure to numbers, spatial relationships, the types of skills that they're going to encounter when they enter the kindergarten classroom. So by having this ability to have earlier exposure to that, it sets them on a nice trajectory. So it's not necessarily about the student's abilities, but rather access to the right types of information to smooth a transition.
One thing that stood out to me in reading about your work is that I believe you said that most of the pre-K teachers are teachers who are sort of in the early stages of their career, but really it's more ideal to have specialist and master's degree teachers. Can you talk a little bit about, it seems obvious why that's important, but I'll bet there's some detail to it.
So this study was conducted in 1999, and at the time, teachers who were teaching in the pre-kindergarten program were compensated on the same state salary schedule as public school teachers in kindergarten through grade 12. So what we found was that the highly educated teachers had tons of years of experience in the classroom, had great experience also with meeting the needs of very young children. So unlike today, where the teachers somewhat change over from year to year, this group of students had access to a caliber of quality in the classroom that really allowed them to flourish in those settings because those teachers had a great deal of experience in fostering the types of academic and social and behavioral outcomes that we were hoping to see.
What are the takeaways for policymakers from your research? What should we be doing or not doing as a matter of public policy?
This study does suggest that Georgia's investment in pre-kindergarten programs is a wise one. I think this also helps parents connect with the expectations for school. We don't have necessarily follow-up data from siblings of the children who are in this program, but by their involvement within the program, there are likely things that those parents learn that translated to other siblings.
You mentioned parents, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some takeaways for parents as a way to either augment what kids are getting in pre-K, or maybe right now kids are not in pre-K. What can parents do to sort of bolster what we're talking about here?
Sure. I would love for all parents to be able to take advantage of the pre-kindergarten program that we have in the state. One other really important takeaway here is that parents' engagement with this early learning program really does foster opportunities for them to be partners in their children's education, to support what would be good expectations for what would be witnessed in the kindergarten classroom. So things that could be very simple as counting the number of steps that they take as they walk into their house every day is reinforcing, you know, very basic mathematical skills under which children are building schemas for future concepts associated with mathematics. So it doesn't take a ton to make a substantial difference.
Great. Stacy Newharth Pritchett is the Associate Dean for Academic Programs and a professor in the University of Georgia's Mary Frances Early College of Education. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
BJ Armstead is passionate about athletics and mental health. He has dedicated his time to helping athletes facing mental health challenges, both on and off the field, as the founder of the nonprofit Apollo Sports Counseling. Armstead, who is also a graduate student in the School of Social Work at the University of Georgia, joins us to talk about the mental health of young athletes today. Welcome to Athens News Matters. To begin with, what led you to start Apollo Sports Counseling?
Well, I wanted to make a change in terms of helping young athletes and helping athletes in general, sort of having them understand the difference between who they are and what they do. I think many times we mix the two, but what happens when we mix the two is we place our value as a person based off of our performance on the field. And I wanted to make sure that I highlighted that as well as provided an outlet emotionally for athletes
And mental health challenges can show up in so many ways. What sort of challenges do you see most commonly among athletes?
Many times it's an anxiety piece. I see a lot of pressure being put on these young athletes, and I see them having to perform no matter what. I think a perfect definition of pressure as far as athletics is concerned is being able to mess up and not being afraid of that after effect of messing up. And I think that there's also a bit of depression there as a result of what happens on the field or on the court. I think there's a stress component there as well. Many athletes are stressed.
In addition to counseling young athletes, you also offer sessions to coaches. Why do you think it's important to counsel coaches, and what impact do these coaches have on the mental health of individual team members?
Yes, I think coaches are important, extremely important. When you talk about the athlete and the team as a whole, though I may be working with a specific athlete or team, that athlete or team will always revert back to that coach as the leader of the team. So coaches are, in my opinion, one of the best people to have conversations with, because then they could carry on the information to parents and to players to impact that athlete's thought pattern in regards to sports and anxiety, depression, trauma, stress.
Do you think coaches are sort of a front line or first line for athletes to see if they're having those issues to help kind of guide them?
I think it is coaches. I think it is a bit of parents as well. I think many times the athletes are going to revert back to what happens at home, and that can have an effect on their performance on the field or on the court.
Have you found that sometimes athletes don't think about seeking counseling? They just kind of suffer in silence because they're just so used to performing?
Most definitely. Most definitely. I think many times athletes' identity is wrapped up into what they do. In essence, we'll take a point guard, for example. If their friends are wrapped up into what they do, or their friends or people in general look at them based off of how they play basketball, so it makes it more difficult for the athlete to not be judged based off of what they do.
Right. And finally, do you have any tips or suggestions athletes can use in their daily lives when they might be feeling anxious, depressed, or stressed?
Absolutely. Many times I will tell athletes to find out what it is that you like doing outside of your sport, and then get friends who enjoy that same thing, because that allows them to sort of have a release and not always think about their sport 24/7, but still do something that they love doing and that keeps them smiling. I think going forward, though, being able to slow life down. I think many times athletes go 100 miles per hour in life because everybody's always chasing to be the best. It is about slowing life down sometimes and breathing. I think my biggest message to all athletes is just make sure that you don't forget that you are a person. Many times we base, you know, I keep saying this, but it's the number one thing that I see. A lot of times we base your value as a person off of how many yards you had this past season, or what your free throw percentage was, how many assists you average, right? These things are literally taking over your value as a person. And you have to understand that you are not a point guard. You are not a shortstop. You are just a person who enjoys playing baseball or enjoys playing basketball. So be conscious of separating the two.
Thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate you for having me.
BJ Armstead is a graduate student at UGA and the founder of Apollo Sports Counseling.
An All Things Considered story starts with the news.
Two women set to become the first female Army Rangers ever.
That day, we wanted to follow it with a conversation from a woman who was in the military.
So we just email everybody.
Whittle it down to one. We get her on the phone.
Welcome to the program, Sergeant Marquez.
Thank you very much, Audie.
I want to start just with your reaction.
There's more to every story on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. The Super Bowl is a big deal, and as we saw last Sunday, even a global pandemic can't stop the pageantry, glitz, and spectacle of the big game. But equally spectacular, or sometimes just controversial, are each year's slate of expensive, big-budget, eye-catching ads. And with a price tag of more than $5 million for 30 seconds of TV time, brands have to bring their A-game. Here to give us his professional opinion about this year's crop is Joseph Watson, the Carolyn Caudell Teager Professor of Public Affairs Communications, Advertising, and Public Relations at UGA's Grady College. Welcome, Joseph.
Good to be here. This is absolute fun to talk about Super Bowl ads.
So to start off with, what is it about Super Bowl advertisements in general that gets the public so excited?
Well, brands realized a long time ago that you have a colossal audience for the Super Bowl. I mean, whole households and families around the country sit down and watch. So it's rare that you have a unified captive audience in this way in today's world. I mean, everyone's on their own devices and their own social media channels, but the Super Bowl is still an opportunity for a bunch of people to all get together and effectively consume the same content, both the game and then the ads between the game.
Right. Well, generally, what elements do you think make a Super Bowl advertisement compelling?
So what makes an ad compelling is you always have to remember that for Super Bowl ads, it's important for the ad to be on brand for the company that's doing it, for the business that's doing it. If it doesn't do that, it's not going to be very effective for them. But what makes it resonate, and this is the same for all advertising, is when you have that happy meeting of great content that's on brand, that's in a particular brand's voice, and it just seems like it's an aha moment that, of course, this is a perfect ad for this particular brand to do. So it has to have all those things in common. That's what makes it stand out, and it doesn't happen all the time.
Now, I'm sure with your background, you're familiar with metrics and how all these things actually move the needle, but can you tell us a little bit about how do they judge whether or not they actually hit a home run with an ad, like as in sales go up or sales don't?
Well, it really depends on that brand. I mean, if you think about, for example, the one of the quirky ads from this past Super Bowl was the Reddit ad, that kind of 5 second and the static, and people were like, what is this? What's wrong or whatever?
Right.
People, you know, actually clicked through and found Reddit as a result of that. And Reddit actually had a message that they posted saying, if you found this, it worked. And so for them, right, you know, they have a certain amount of click-throughs that they want to achieve, and they achieve that number, that tells them that they've achieved their metric. Now, if you're a consumer brand and your goal is, for example, if you're, you know, trying to sell Mountain Dew and they have the Mountain Dew Major ad with John Cena, you can tell very quickly, have you seen an uptick in your unit sales in a particular window of time? And so it's much easier to quantify. The ones that are more difficult to quantify are the ones that are the more sophisticated ads that are designed to enhance a particular brand's reputation, which is going to be something that's going to be measured over a longer period of time than just sales or click-throughs.
Right. Well, you know, this year certainly was vastly different from other Super Bowls, given that we've been dealing with a pandemic as well as cries for social change. In your opinion, who did the best job of catering to the feeling of the current times?
You know, I think that the Ford ad, the kind of, you know, get through it ad, I'm not sure if you had a chance to see that one, you know, that one I thought was very effective. I think that the Jeep Springsteen ad, in terms of,
sure,
of capturing the political polarization and divisiveness that we have right now was very effective. But, you know, there were not so many of those kinds of ads. A lot of the right ads were lighter. But I would say that I think that the Ford and the Jeep ads, I thought, did best in terms of addressing the tone that we're in right now.
Well, speaking of tone, did you feel like there were some that were just, well, tone deaf?
I think it's always hard to do humor, and it's very hard to do it effectively. And so some of them just missed. I thought the Oatly ad just was a miss.
Made for humans.
It just didn't work. I just thought it was terrible. And I think you have to straddle, you know, especially when you're trying to do humor. But you want the humor to draw people in. You don't want it to be annoying. And I thought, I listened to that, it was annoying. Some ads I thought just stayed around too long.
The oat milk ad, I've got to say, when that concluded, my wife looked at me and said, well, that was money well spent.
It's funny you said that, because I said to my wife, I said, you know, I cannot believe someone paid for that content.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, paid to have this produced and someone pitched this and there's somebody actually earned big money on it, and they did a colossal multi-million-dollar ad buy for this. I mean, I'm just kind of like shocked. But some ads really did work. And I think I'll say one that I thought had me laughing out loud was the Alexa ad with Michael B. Jordan, you know, and the lady keeps going to see Michael B. Jordan and her husband's trying to turn it off.
Alexa, turn on the sprinklers. Honey, I already ran the sprinklers. Things are getting way too wet around here.
That one I thought was absolutely hilarious. And so there are a few like that that really worked and had a very good tone.
For the record, that was my favorite of all time. I mean, when I saw that one, not only did I chuckle, but I couldn't wait for the next moment. Like, what are they going to do with him now?
Read my audiobook.
I was in his hands. I was being chained.
But the best part is the husband knocking at the door. Said, you know, there are other people who want to use the bathroom in here.
That I was also kissing him.
Honey, other people have to use the bathroom around here, too.
And here's the thing that makes an ad like that work. Because that ad tells you exactly what Alexa does. You understand exactly what the Alexa device does and why people love the Alexa device and everything else, but it uses humor to show the ubiquitousness of how effective having Alexa is. But you don't really realize in watching the ad that you're learning all about Alexa. You just really are being, you know, supremely entertained with this lady and obsessing over Michael B. Jordan or to her husband's chagrin. So
good, really so good. Joseph Watson is the Carolyn Caudell Teager Professor of Public Affairs, Communications, Advertising, and Public Relations at UGA's Grady College, and an absolute delight to talk to. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure, Chris.
Before we move on, one additional note to add to this story. News that Jeep has actually pulled their ad featuring Bruce Springsteen following a report that the singer was arrested for DWI last November. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Emma Turner, Lucas Trevor, Megan Wan, Devin Zwald, Jessica Wurst, and Isabella Liu. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
As always, you can listen back to today's stories and all of our stories on our website at WUGA.org or on the WUGA mobile app, available for Apple and Android. And of course, we'd like for you to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at WUGA-FM. For Chris Shoup, I'm Alexia Ridley, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News.